Where do nations turn when they find themselves in a financial crisis? Lately, we see the growing trend of nations developing a dependence on government to take responsibility for its citizens' economic well-being. This reliance, in turn, leads to greater government control and consolidation of power in the hands of a few. Dr. David Jeremiah shows us how the consolidation of political and economic power will set the stage for the ultimate in evil governance as he continues his series, The Coming Economic Armageddon. Now, here's David with more on today's message.
And thank you for joining us today. Today, we are going to look at a story from the Old Testament, and we're going to learn a lesson from this story that you probably would never have dreamed is there. And we will give you more information about that in our introduction in just a few moments. Today's message is entitled, From Crisis to Consolidation. We are witnessing the fulfillment of this prophecy right before our eyes. This is a chapter from the book, The Coming Economic Armageddon. And that book, 291-page hardback book, is available to you during the month of October only, for a gift of any size to Turning Point. We would love to send you a copy of this book as our way of saying thank you for your gift to this ministry. And when you make your gift generous, everything that comes in from your gift above and beyond the actual cost of the book and its mailing to you, that will be invested in more stations, more opportunities for us to share this truth across the nation and around the world. So thank you for your generosity, and we look forward to sharing this book with you in the next few days. Well, we are today in Greensboro, North Carolina, awaiting the opportunity to meet with our many friends tonight at our first fall rally in the Greensboro Coliseum. As you know, this is a ticketed event, but the tickets are free, and many of you have tickets and are planning to come. Let me remind you again that if you ordered tickets, please use them, because we have given tickets to everyone who's requested them. They're free. As I've said before, sometimes when we get things for free, we don't value them. But I want you to value these tickets and be with us tonight as we kick off the rally season. Charles Billingsley will lead us in worship, and the Hoppers will be bringing special music. And then I'll be speaking from the information that is in the Word of God concerning the coming economic Armageddon. We are looking forward to a great night of worship and praise. The gospel will be presented, and you can be sure to bring your friends who may not know Christ. We will share with them the way of the cross. It could be a great night of victory for many. We ask you to pray with us today, throughout the day, that God will come down and meet with us tonight in Greensboro as we hold our first fall rally together. Well, today we're going to look at the story of Joseph, as we talk about from crisis to consolidation. Open your Bibles, open your hearts. Let's begin our study.
The announcement on a day in early May that the European Union and the International Monetary Fund had agreed to a $140 billion bailout plan for Greece was really good news for that debt-ridden nation. But I don't know if you noticed, they didn't act like it was good news. It led to public employee strikes and days of riots, and three people died in the process. There were at least two possible reasons. Perhaps the fear that the rescue would only delay their inevitable bankruptcy by a few months was the first. In other words, the bailout just was not sufficient, and so they were frustrated. The second was that the Greek people objected to the harsh measures imposed by Germany and the other European Union countries as a condition for getting the money that they were given. These measures included higher consumer taxes, significant cuts in pensions, civil servants' pay. In reality, this meant the citizens were being asked to contribute over $38 billion of their own dollars to try to bail out their problem. Beyond the burning barricades and the firebombed buildings was widespread anger that the entire country would have to bear the burden of accumulated decades of corruption and mismanagement by the political elite of their nation. Does that sound at all familiar? Greece may be the first of many nations that seem headed toward a similar crisis. For example, with its budget deficit of 11.6% of its GDP, Great Britain's government promised more than it could afford to deliver, and as you now know, it cost Gordon Brown his position as Prime Minister of the nation. The U.S. is also facing double-digit budget deficits And listen carefully, the federal government will borrow 40% of the $3.6 trillion it's on course to spend this fiscal year. Those are two astounding numbers, that we're going to spend $3.6 trillion, and number two, that we have to borrow 40% of it in order just to survive. In spite of all of this massive spending, or perhaps because of it, the American economy just seems to be getting worse. In the same week as the Greek riots, the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics reported that 290,000 new jobs had been discovered and that we were continuing to deal with the employment problem. But this seemingly good news turned out to be not so good. Many of those new jobs were only temporary census positions, just a little sleight of hand here and there. Factoring in the new crop of high school and college graduates entering the job market and competing for these jobs, the unemployment rate actually went up from 9.7 to 9.9. Far from confirming that the recession was over, the newly created jobs were simply not enough, and 15.3 million Americans continue to be unemployed. If you've ever been a dependent on an employment check, if you've ever had to go and get your unemployment check and try to live on it, you know that it's barely adequate to pay even the most basic bill. In fact, the New York Times reported during this time about a woman who lived in Queens who had been unemployed since 2008 when her company downsized in the financial crisis. She was at that time earning $65,000 a year. She went to receiving $430 a month in unemployment benefits. Those benefits finally ran out in April 2010, and she has not been able to find a new employment opportunity, even though she seeks for it every day. With no income or health insurance, she was barely getting by, and the paper quoted her as saying, "I would rather be out working, and I can't find anything. It's not because I'm not trying. This economy is broke." The growing financial pressure on the average person in this world brings to mind the famous first sentence of Charles Dickens' novel. You remember it. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. In short, the period was so far like the present period, for good or for evil. That's the way The Tale of Two Cities begins. It's a classic story of two cities, dominant cities in the world of Dickens' day. The cities were London and Paris. If he were writing today, I'm sure Charles Dickens would expand his cities. Maybe he would add two or three more. Maybe it would be Washington, D.C., and London and Athens, all of which would work very well as cities in the midst of the crisis. In each of these political crises that I have mentioned, the problem was created largely by growing dependence upon the government to take the responsibility for its citizens' well-being. This dependence in turn leads to greater government control and a consolidation of power in the hands of just a few people. Like the frog in the kettle, the citizens focused on their own comfort tend not to notice that more and more of their lives are being controlled by somebody else. Nor do they seem to care as long as their needs are being met, as long as their comfort level is maintained. But as we will see later on, this casual acceptance of government dependence is leading us into severe results that loom just around the corner for every one of us. It is as true today as it was in the French Revolution. With their way of life at risk, desperate people will sometimes do desperate things. Scarcity of money, scarcity of jobs, not enough food will lead people to accept extreme measures just to survive. In his book, When a Nation Forgets God, Erwin Lutzer says, "It was Lenin's promise of bread in every kitchen that ignited the communist revolution. Bread with political slavery was better than freedom and starvation. Bread fills the stomach, freedom does not." In times of despair, people often move to accept a strong centralized government to provide for them. A centralized government is one in which all the authority in the country is vested in one person or in a very limited group of people, and to whom all other governments, state and local, become responsible. If you know anything about our history as a nation, you know that the founders of the United States knew personally the oppressive implications of such a form of government. So they purposed that the colonies would be under a federated system of decentralized government in which every state holds home rule sovereignty under the limits of the Constitution. It was this type of government that allows a free market economy regulated by just laws rather than restrictive dictatorial control. I don't think there's any doubt that our nation has for years been experiencing a shift away from the intent of the founding fathers and toward a heavily centralized government. And there are several reasons why I believe that. Let me share them with you. First of all, the federal budget. One of the clearest indicators of our nation's move toward a consolidated government is the way our government spends our money. Beginning slowly but with exponentially accelerating speed, government spending has both ballooned and shifted in emphasis from necessities to entitlements, with a corresponding shift in priorities. David M. Walker waves a red flag of warning with this observation. Listen to these words. He said, in fiscal 2008, you could trace less than 40% of our federal government spending back to the responsibilities that were envisioned by the founders. In budget language, all of those original programs that were supposed to be handled by the federal budget have now become discretionary in the Constitution and are being replaced with a lot of other things that never were intended to be covered by the United States government. Big government is now an established fact in the United States, and it's about to get much bigger. In the aftermath of our recent financial crisis, the cost of our government has mushroomed into an even larger percentage of our GDP. If the workforce necessary to manage the new tax initiatives and healthcare programs is anywhere near what has been projected, we will soon be a full-fledged socialist state. What about our banks? Oh, do we know about our banks? Another indicator of consolidation can be found in our banking institutions. Did you know that in 1940, there were 14,399 banks in the United States? And today, we don't even have half that many, and the number continues to drop every year. Long gone are the days when a banker actually knew his depositors and took care to ascertain their credit worthiness for loans or mortgages. Such scrutinizing tactics are deemed too expensive these days. The increased risk and expense of loan default is passed on to the customer in the form of higher priced financial services, fewer personal loans, higher credit card finance charges, and lower credit card limits. One of the worldwide results of recent global financial crisis has been the consolidation, concentration, and control of the world's money by a dwindling number of banks. The primary fallout from consolidation is that it leads to greater government control through intervention and regulation. One such consolidation took place on October 30th, 2009, right here in our corner of the world. I remember when I first moved to California back in 1981, one of the most honored and respected organizations in our community was the San Diego National Bank. That once proud San Diego National Bank became a failure statistic. It is now one of the 140 banks in the United States that failed and was taken over by the FDIC. All 28 of the branch offices operating under the name of the San Diego National Bank closed at the end of one day and opened the next day under a new name, the U.S. Bank of Minneapolis. Without a word of warning, customers of 8 other banking institutions from Arizona to Illinois to Texas faced the same surprise that day. Without any action or approval on their part, the customers now had a new bank with a new name and a new owner. The switchover was seamless. The old bank ATM cards worked flawlessly with the new bank's machines, and their direct deposits and automatic withdrawals were simply transferred to the new bank. According to the FDIC, in the first 117 days of 2010, 72 more banks were added to the list of failed institutions. The total 2009 payout from the FDIC funds topped out at $36 billion, twice the payout rate of 2008. These closures meant the loss of thousands of jobs in the financial sector. At this rate, small bankers may soon become an endangered species. Now, small banks are becoming extinct. Big consolidated financial institutions that have been rescued by the government bailouts managed to pull out all of the stops and come up with some unbelievable things. For instance, the Bank of America, J.P. Morgan, Citibank, and Goldman Sachs managed to pay back their billions of dollars in bailout funds ahead of time. Then amazingly, in the first quarter of 2010, not one of these banking giants posted a loss. A virtually amazing feat equivalent to four different major league pitchers throwing a perfect game on the same day. As one New York Times financial writer put it, in 2009, the banks posted losses on less than 20% of the trading days. During the turmoil of 2008, losses occurred on 40% of the time. Now, how did this happen? How could they have such an astounding turnaround? How was it possible? Was some kind of manipulation going on here? Some suspect it was a pre-planned event designed to show the effectiveness of government intervention, thus furthering the argument for more regulation. And that brings us to the next evidence that shows the trend toward major concentration of power in a big government. Plans for more regulation sent President Obama to the heart of Wall Street on April 13, 2010, to drum up support for a bill that would end the too-big-to-fail phenomenon by increasing government regulation over the financial sector. In his speech, Obama insisted that reform of financial institution is necessary to make certain that taxpayers are never again on the hook because a firm is deemed too big to fail. A vote for reform is a vote to put a stop to taxpayer-funded bailouts. Not only will it safeguard our system, he said, this will also make our system stronger and more competitive by installing confidence here at home and across the globe. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner also weighed in on the matter, saying financial reform is not the war of choice, it's the war of necessity. And beneath the rhetoric of necessity and public protection, there can be little doubt that financial regulation is just another way to make big government bigger and bigger and bigger. And then there's the stock market. Wait till you hear about this. Then there's the strange case of the stock market flash crash, the miracle of early May 2010. Some of you who are into the market will know all about this. If you're a market watcher, you may have experienced simultaneous apoplexy and then angina as the stock market took a frightening bungee ride that Tuesday. Call it panic buying, a plunge, a market correction, some other euphemism. The Dow Jones Industrial Average posted its greatest intraday loss since the crash of 1987. The hour-by-hour graph of that day's trading showed a gradual decline until shortly after 2:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, the bottom dropped out. In just 5 minutes, the Dow was down 400 to 800 points. It went on to lose nearly 1,000 points in that precipitous dive. At 2:40 p.m., the descent stopped with a curious and startling upward jerk, as if the bungee cord had reached its nadir and its rider was sent vaulting back up the apex. By 3:40 p.m., the Dow had recovered 383.17 points, an almost miraculous recovery in the space of less than an hour. At the 4 o'clock closing bell, the ride was over and the Dow had leveled off to a loss of 348 points for the day. A financial miracle? Maybe not. You probably heard all the reasons that were put out there to try to explain what happened. Let me just tell you what I think happened. There must be a logical explanation for such a dramatic turnaround. Some were offered. It was a technical glitch. They were saying that all of this is done now electronically, and there was some kind of technical glitch, and it caused all this. Not a sell-off. There were fears of the euro contagion that had grabbed hold of Germany's vote to aid Greece's recovery. Consumer spending was up, and oh yes, in advance of its official release the following morning, the April unemployment data was leaked, that it was supposedly good, indicating another month of job creation. Still, there was hardly enough good news in all of that put together to produce such an amazing result. It would appear more likely that there might have been intervention by behind-the-scenes committee. Now, I'm going to tell you something that I don't know how I missed, because I didn't know this until recently, but let me just give you this little information. Back in 1988, our good friend, the President Ronald Reagan, created by executive order what has been referred to as the Plunge Protection Team, or sometimes the Four Dictators. The group includes the heads of the Federal Reserve, the U.S. Treasury, the Security and Exchange Commission, and the Commodity Futures Trading Association. In order, the current members are Ben Bernanke, Timothy Geithner, Mary Shapiro, and Gary Gensler. The committee functions under executive order number 12631, and it's to intercede when the stock market appears headed for a plunge. Please note that the people do not elect these officials. They are all selected by the President of the United States. The plunge protection team has been called in to execute a rescue on three occasions since September the 11th, 2001, January 2008, October 2008, and most recently, May 6th, 2010. American investment expert Robert Kiyosaki is straightforward in his opinion of the limits of this team's future effectiveness. He said, "I believe the end is near. I believe the four dictators will be unable to prevent many more plunges. When they can't stop the plunge, the poor and the middle class will be wiped out." The PPT, or the Plunge Protection Team, acts only upon the directive of the United States of America, and as we assume, in the best interest of the American people. There is, however, a good deal of suspicion directed toward this group. Credible sources charge that the Federal Reserve and the Treasury, in league with top Wall Street firms, are rigging the stock market on a daily basis, and the stock market is not really a free market anymore. For example, in January 2010, stock analyst Charles Bitterman said, "The massive stock market rally in the past 9 months is mostly due to secret government buying of stock index futures. As of early May, that nine-month stretch of growth has increased to 14 months. If it is true that market manipulation is taking place, we must remember that such buying of stocks by the Federal Reserve, no matter how the end might justify the means, is illegal." The PPT is simply more power and wealth consolidated in the hands of a few. Since the president selects these four people, it is actually power consolidated in one man. As the examples have shown, this process of ever-increasing consolidation of power in the hands of fewer and fewer people is well underway.
And it is the scenario that must be present for the future prophetic events to transpire. More about crisis to consolidation tomorrow here on Turning Point. Thank you for joining us today. We are walking through these discussions of the coming economic Armageddon, and we are making available this brand new book from Hachette Publishing to everyone who will make a gift to Turning Point during the month of October. When you send your gift of any size, we would like to send you the hardback copy of this 291-page book. There are almost 10 pages of resources in the back of this book. We have really worked hard to get the truth, the information that we really all need to have in this day. And it's in this book, and it's available to you for a gift to Turning Point during the month of October. Well, in just a few hours, or perhaps a few minutes, depending on where you live, we will be beginning our fall rally season in Greensboro at the Greensboro Coliseum. It promises to be a night of great encouragement and blessing, and we ask you to pray with us in these moments that are left before the event, that God would really meet with us in a special way, and we can begin to see His hand working in our lives. People ask me all over the country, what is going to turn this nation around? And I remind them that the pattern of the Word of God is that before He turns a nation around, He has to turn His people around. And that wonderful passage from the Old Testament says, "If my people, which are called by my name, will humble themselves and ask for forgiveness," and it all puts the onus back on God's people. So we are right to meet as the people of God and seek God's face as we look forward to the uncertainties of the future.
Introducing Dr. David Jeremiah's 9 Biblical Money Management Principles That Will Change Your Life. This compact resource features 9 powerful things the Bible has to say about money and finances. Based on 126 New Testament principles and more than 2,000 Bible verses, these 9 truths capture the essence of what you need to better handle the resources God has given you. 9 Biblical Money Management Principles That Will Change Your Life. Yours free when you contact Turning Point. Call or click today.
Well, this is just another way we can encourage you. I found these principles when I was writing this book, and I kept writing them down and going back and looking at them and thinking, these are timeless. These are from the Bible, and they work so well in today's economy. You will be amazed when you read these scriptures and the principles that go with them, that if we put these into practice, we would save ourselves a lot of grief when we deal with the finances that are ours to control during this day. Anyway, it's just a way for us to encourage you. They're absolutely free. You don't have to send anything. Just ask for them when you call or write today. Well, pray that God will meet with us tonight. We're in Greensboro for our first event. We're so excited about it. We're looking forward to seeing many of you tonight, and we'll be right back here on this station tomorrow.
The message you heard today originated in the pulpit of Shadow Mountain Community Church, where David serves as senior pastor. Please take a moment to share what God is doing in your life through this ministry by writing to Turning Point, Post Office Box 3838, San Diego, California 92163. You can also contact us when you visit our website at davidjeremiah.org/radio or call 800-947-1993. When you call or visit online, request this month's resource, The Coming Economic Armageddon. This new book by Dr. David Jeremiah addresses aspects of the current and future economic changes in our world, and it reminds us to keep our trust in God alone, our only true source of safety and security. It's yours today for a gift of any amount. Just visit davidjeremiah.org/radio. This is Mark Larson. Join us tomorrow as we continue the series, The Coming Economic Armageddon, on Turning Point with Dr. David Jeremiah.